Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Palestinian president without a state, Mahmoud Abbas, is said to be a quiet, affable man, but he has really blown open the doors at the UN this week with a promise to step to the podium of the General Assembly tomorrow and demand full UN membership. In effect, UN recognition of Palestinian statehood. That one not-by-the-book play is shaking everything. It has challenged American global influence and this American president and Israel in the teeth of the Arab Spring. This hour On Point, the Palestinian move for statehood recognition at the UN. You can join the conversation. Do you understand why the Palestinians have played this card? Do you understand why Israel's government is so upset? Why the U.S. is saying no? How do you think this plays out? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's the president at the podium in the General Assembly yesterday saying peace is important, but bottom line, Israel is a friend of the United States.
We seek a future where Palestinians live in a sovereign state of their own, with no limit to what they can achieve. And there's no question that the Palestinians have seen that vision delayed for too long. It is precisely because we believe so strongly in the aspirations of the Palestinian people that America has invested so much time and so much effort in the building of a Palestinian state and the negotiations that can deliver a Palestinian state. But understand this as well. America's commitment to Israel's security is unshakable.
And, said the president, peace will not come through the UN. Joining me now from the United Nations in New York to explain exactly what the Palestinian move would mean and where it stands is Joe Loria, UN correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Joe, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
What is the anticipated train of events here now?
Well, I'd like to grab the opportunity to clear up what I think has been a lot of misleading and incorrect reporting and confusion about this entire matter. On both the timing and what the Palestinians are really trying to do. There was, for example, there was never going to be a vote this week, although that was widely reported. Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, last Friday said that this Friday, tomorrow, he would present a formal application for membership in the UN, not statehood, and that this normally takes time, any Security Council resolution, and the U.S. is planning to drag it out as long as possible, and they're also trying to make sure that there aren't 9 votes to pass such a resolution. Once it's passed in the Security Council, it's a recommendation to the General Assembly where you need 2/3 majority to become a full member of the UN. So the U.S. is lobbying very fiercely to try not to get 9 votes. If necessary, they will veto this resolution. And during this period, they want to try to get negotiations going again. And the Palestinians feel that membership would give them more leverage in those negotiations. But Palestinian PLO Executive Committee member Nabil Shayet yesterday said that the Palestinians are willing to wait for some time, he didn't specify, maybe a month or so, while this Security Council process plays out.
What are the odds of them breaking somebody off of those 9 votes, of the U.S. succeeding in that, Joe?
Pretty good right now, apparently, although 9 of them, and I'm going to get to this in a moment about what recognition means, 9 of the Security Council members have recognized Palestine already as a state. Some of them have embassies in their capitals with Palestinian ambassadors. So they have to work on some of them, and I understand Colombia and Gabon, with the French leaning on Gabon and the U.S. on Colombia and Bosnia-Herzegovina, all of whom have recognized Palestine as a state already, could abstain, and that would not give the 9 votes. So the Palestinians are willing to wait. There were never going to be a vote this week in the Security Council, and they're willing to wait before they go to the General Assembly for 2 other options that they have. So that is incorrect to say they were going to vote. And some of the papers that said they were going to vote this week and now reporting that they've changed their mind or they're dropping their bid. It's all incorrect.
Joe, you're
never going to vote.
You've reported that even if they just get an incremental upgrade of its status at the UN, it would subject Israel's military to international courts for actions in Palestinian territory. It would allow Palestinian control of Israeli-patrolled airspace and waters off Gaza. So there are real ramifications here on the ground.
There are. I just want to explain that the UN doesn't recognize states. Governments recognize states, and the Palestinians are not going for states. They're going for membership. And you have to already be a state to apply. Now, the Palestinian Authority declared independence on November 15, 1988. Someone actually went outside the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem and read the Declaration of Independence, very much like someone went outside in the courtyard of the Philadelphia State House the 1776 to read the U.S. Declaration of Independence. And since 1988, 130 countries have recognized Palestine. They have embassies and ambassadors, many of them. And no American media is really reporting this crucial factor. So this
I understand that there is
already a state.
Yeah, there is exactly as you say that the UN sort of chapter and verse on what it means is also at the same time how it's understood symbolically. If it does go to the General Assembly, and that may be way down the road now, but if it does, would that have the same effect? What are the odds of passage there of what they're asking for? What would it be?
Well, they have two options to go to the. See, the U.S. doesn't recognize it as a state. That's why they would veto them in the Security Council. But in the General Assembly, they can go for this is still very much alive, a Uniting for Peace resolution, which is based on a 1950 U.S. resolution to get around Security Council vetoes. The U.S. did this because the Soviets kept vetoing resolutions on the Korean conflict. They could go there. They think, this is Francis Borrell, their lead legal advisor, and Hanna Ashrari, their PLO executive committee member, said yesterday they're still keeping this option open. It's going to be difficult because they have to get two-thirds of the assembly to agree that membership would be a defense against Israeli aggression. So more likely they would then go to the General Assembly to get an observer state status. So they only need a simple majority of 97. And since 130 countries recognize them, that's almost an assured thing. With that, they would get, as you said, they would have the right to join the International Criminal Court, the Law of the Sea Treaty, the International Civil Aviation Organization. What does that mean? They would have control, full sovereignty over their airspace and their waters. It would be as if they could go to the International Court of Justice, the World Court, and sue Israel for the blockade, saying that they are now in our national waters off Gaza.
The blockade, which is on now and has been for some time, and of course Israel controls the airspace over the West Bank and Gaza.
The ICC worries Israel and the U.S. very much because any activity by the Israeli military on the West Bank, which would now be considered an observer state, could be brought to the ICC for investigation into crimes against humanity or war crimes. So there are real concrete things they are going to get. It doesn't look like anybody could stop them from getting that unless the peace talks can begin before that. But, of course, that goes into the issue of the settlement freeze and that condition.
All the rest. So you're saying no vote tomorrow, but this will be before the Security Council tomorrow, and the wheels turn from there. Joe Loria with The Wall Street Journal, UN correspondent there. Thank you very much for joining us, Joe.
Thank you, Tom.
Joining us now from Washington is Jake Tapper, senior White House correspondent for ABC News. He's been in New York this week with the president. Jake, thanks very much. What's the White House saying about where things stand in the UN on the Palestinian effort?
Well, as was just explained, they are trying to desperately do everything they can to avoid being in a position of vetoing statehood for the Palestinian people. That's not a move they want to do. Unfortunately, for their efforts, they have not been able to convince the Palestinians so far to drop the bid. And so it looks like the Palestinians will go forward and introduce this measure in the Security Council tomorrow. As far as President Obama is concerned, this is a huge disappointment.
You heard Joe there saying there's a U.S., a Washington hope that maybe they can convince some others on the Security Council not to go with this. How bright a hope is that at this point for the Obama administration?
Well, every country has their own pressures. That is something that some members of the of organizations that are the lobby for Israel say that it's their understanding that there are not the 9 votes needed, and so this can be avoided, because I think what people need to understand is the United States and other countries are very worried about what the repercussions will be if the U.S. vetoes statehood for or member state I should say membership in the UN statehood recognition as a sovereign nation in the United Nations.
Can you lay out those repercussions, Jake? What are they worried about? What's the scenario they fear?
They're worried about passions in the region being inflamed. They're worried about passions in the Muslim and Arab worlds being inflamed. The president, obviously, from the very beginning of his administration, has reached out and tried to put on a different face to the Arab and Muslim worlds than, for instance, the administration of George W. Bush did.
Mm-hmm.
And they are worried about, because let's be honest, this is one of the biggest issues held against the United States, rightly or wrongly, by the Arab street, by the Muslim street, the United States' support for Israel and, in their view, in the view of many Arabs and Muslims, opposition to the rights, the human rights of the Palestinian people. And now, look, we can get into why that is and the fact that Arab countries and Arab leaders use that as a wedge issue to distract from their own human rights abuses and so on. Whatever the reason for it, the dynamic exists. And French President Nicolas Sarkozy yesterday, when he was proposing his alternative plan for observer status for the United Nations, for the Palestinians instead of member status, he said, you know, this is going to engender violence in the region if there is a veto of this.
What this president stalwart, though, yesterday promising to oppose this, but you say they're desperate to avoid it. What will that veto cost the U.S., Jake?
It's hard to quantify something like that. It certainly costs goodwill and efforts at goodwill. President Obama going to Cairo in the first few months of his term, giving his big address to the Muslim world, talking, this president has really made, I think the first interview, television interview he gave was to an Arab television network that mm-hmm. This has been a big issue for him, improving the view, and we should note it has not been successful as of yet, according to a poll by the Pew Pew organization. The view of the United States remains generally negative in the Arab and Muslim worlds. But that said, this has been a big issue for him, and he doesn't want to be put in this position. But the alternative is worse in the view of the president, and that is what are the prospects for peace in the Middle East if all of a sudden, with one vote, Israel is occupying a sovereign nation in the view of the United Nations.
And so a tough veto vote may be looming here in the very teeth of the Arab Spring. Jake Tapper with ABC News, senior White House correspondent there. Thank you so much for being with us, Jake.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Palestinian move for full membership at the United Nations, the trappings of statehood and recognition there, and its implications for the Palestinians, for Israel, and for the United States. The president before the General Assembly yesterday, here he is saying this is not the way to go.
Now, I know that many are frustrated by the lack of progress. I assure you, so am I. But the question isn't the goal that we seek. The question is, how do we reach that goal? And I am convinced that there is no shortcut to the end of a conflict that has endured for decades. Peace is hard work. Peace will not come through statements and resolutions at the United Nations. If it were that easy, it would have been accomplished by now.
It would have been accomplished by now. He's got the entire region, the Arab Spring and Israel in front of him, a lot of American politics behind him. Here's some sound of that, speaking alongside a group of conservative Jewish leaders in New York City Tuesday. GOP candidate and Texas Governor Rick Perry slammed President Obama's policy on Israel.
Simply put, we would not be here today at this very precipice of such a dangerous move if the Obama policy in the Middle East wasn't naive and arrogant, misguided and dangerous.
There's a list for you. High, high stakes right here. Joining us now from Washington, Aaron David Miller, public policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholar. He's been advisor to six secretaries of state, deputy special Middle East coordinator for Arab-Israeli negotiations, and senior member of the State Department's policy planning staff. His forthcoming book out next year is Can America Have Another Great President? This one under a lot of pressure right now. Aaron David Miller, welcome back. Thank you for being with us.
Tom, pleasure to be here.
And with us from New York today, often been with us from Paris, Christopher Dickey, Paris Bureau Chief and Middle East Editor for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, author of Securing the City. Christopher Dickey. Chris, welcome back to On Point.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Aaron David Miller, first to you. Wow. I mean, we see big language around this conflict, but it seldom gets bigger than right now. We've got Ehud Olmert, former Prime Minister, in the New York Times today saying, This is just an impossible situation, and that Palestinians and Israelis need to kind of do something right now, or we may have a generation or more lost chance and very grim scenario in the Mideast. Is it as bad as that, Aaron?
I think it's bad, but the reality is, or the question is, what can they do? I mean, neither Benjamin Netanyahu nor Mahmoud Abbas, nor Barack Obama for that matter, nor the EU, nor Nicolas Sarkozy, nor anyone has the will and the capacity right now to push Israelis and Palestinians toward a conflict-ending solution. I choose my words very carefully here. A conflict-ending solution to the Israeli-Palestinian problem. One that conclusively resolves Jerusalem, border security, and refugees, and the new fifth element, which the prime minister has added, Israel's desire to see Israel recognized as the nation-state of the Jewish people. Let me be very clear. The real crisis is not what's playing out in almost hysterical sky-is-falling fashion in New York at the UN General Assembly and the UN Security Council. The real crisis is the improbability, I would argue, impossibility right now of seeing negotiations sustainable and serious to produce that outcome. That's the real crisis. And the day after, and there will be a day after, whether it's a quartet statement or a veto by the United States or a cleverly crafted UN General Assembly resolution or some French compromise, the day after will present the same basic challenge. And I won't even insult your intelligence by suggesting that anybody has a solution to fix that problem.
Ehud Olmert, former prime minister of Israel, says jump in right now and negotiate the outlines of a deal there and let's get going on it. Christopher Dickey, you know, Aaron David Miller looks at this and says he sees something almost hysterical in the response to this, and yet the stakes are high, and this is the first time that we've seen anything like this post the Arab Spring. I mean, isn't that what, the day after the veto, you've got everybody staring at a region that's in this flush of pride and excitement over exactly asserting itself against, you know, what they see as oppression of all kinds. Where does that leave Israel, the United States, the Palestinians, Chris?
Well, that is really the new given here. I mean, you know, the outlines of a deal have been in place for a very long time, since Aaron helped to put them together many years ago. And it's not inconceivable that peace could be made somehow, but Israel has to figure out whether it wants to live as part of the Middle East or not, because the Middle East is changing, and a lot of the objections that Israelis raised to the governments around them, which were not always sincere, that they were dictatorships, that they were tyrannies, that Israel was the only democracy, all of that is changing and evolving right now. And Israel is in the extremely awkward position over the medium and long term of having to find a way not to make peace with governments, but to make peace with the peoples around it. And it's nowhere close to doing that. And the way it's dealing with the Palestinians now, and this issue of the UN vote is part of it, is only going to make that task more difficult.
New York Times today, Christopher Dickey, is saying, you know, the United States has already looked sidelined here, no longer the key player. It's not just about the U.S. and Israel and Palestinians anymore. Everybody's talking about the Arab Spring and what this means in that context. We're trying to put the president, again, very strong yesterday, saying we will stand with Israel on this. Prime Minister Netanyahu saying that's a badge of honor for you that you've said that, Mr. President. But this desperation Jake Tapper talked about seems to come from what Washington expects is a high price tag for this. What does that price tag look like, Christopher?
Well, you know, it's not going to change much on the ground, as Aaron suggests. It really isn't going to change much on the ground for the Israelis or the Palestinians. But Washington is completely screwed on this one. It is trying to back democratic movements. The Arab Spring, particularly in Egypt, represented finally very much what Barack Obama had been advocating for the Arabs and indeed for the Palestinians over the years, peaceful resistance, emulate Martin Luther King and Gandhi. All of that happened. There are many Palestinians would like that to happen in Israel or in the Palestinian territories, but Obama's left nowhere. He's left backing the occupying force on this one, and I think that's just an extremely difficult position for him.
Aaron David Miller, you've got Republicans stepping up and saying they're absolutely solid with the Netanyahu government on this. President Obama and Netanyahu yesterday, right next to each other there, badge of honor, said Netanyahu. Then you've got all kinds of interpretations. Tom Friedman in the New York Times calls this the most diplomatically inept and strategically incompetent government in Israel's history. Says that Netanyahu's government may plunge Israel into deeper global isolation and drag America along with it. Where does that interpretation come from, Aaron?
You know, we're acting as if, and I'm an American, not an Israeli or Palestinian, and I devoted a pretty good piece of my professional life to helping the Israelis and the Palestinians and the Arabs and Israelis with all of our imperfections and my imperfections and in recommendations. But I have to tell you, as I sit here as an American, and the reality is we have a much diminished president presiding over the two longest wars in American history, wars we cannot win, wars where the standard of victory is not can we win, but when can we leave.
Mm-hmm.
We're poised on the verge, perhaps, of a recession or at least a recovery that will take years to think. And this is where I have very little patience, certainly on the part of Israelis and Palestinians who continue to whine and complain that America holds the key, that America can deliver this. I'm tired of hearing this.
But that's not what Friedman's saying.
Look, Tom is a friend. I'm not even interested in what Tom's saying. What I'm trying to render here is that Barack Obama, governing is about choosing. It's about setting your priorities. I voted for this guy. I'm not entirely sure why, but I voted for him.
But he didn't start the wars you're complaining about.
But I don't want him chasing a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, expending any political capital, giving the pro-Israeli community and the Republicans an issue to hammer him at a time when he needs to be husbanding his capital and currency to deal with the crisis that is confronting this country. And the notion that this is not cheap politics on Obama's part. This is not dirty politics on Obama's part.
Who
this
said
is smart
that?
Politics.
Who's talking about cheap, dirty politics?
There are so many people who believe that the president's speech at the UN General Assembly was simply a bald effort to pander to the government of Israel and the pro-Israeli community. Of course the president is focused now on a sustainable domestic constituency. Of course he's focused on his re-election, and he should be. And the reality is there is no reason right now for what I would describe to you as an unproductive fight with the government of Israel and Republicans in Congress on an issue, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, that cannot be resolved. There are moments, and I participated in them, when fighting with the Israelis, which is an occupational reality for serious peacemaking. If you don't fight with Israel, and to a large extent with the Arabs and the Palestinians, over these issues, you are not doing what you need to do as a mediator. But to have an unproductive fight, to have a fight that gets you nowhere over a UN resolution, criticizing what most Americans continue to look at as certainly Congress, and that counts in Washington, as a close American ally, no matter how badly it may be behaving, makes no sense for a president.
But he didn't fight.
Who has other priorities?
But he didn't fight.
That's my point.
Yeah, he went the other way, and you said he needs to. He has to.
Exactly.
Miller doesn't care about what Tom Friedman thinks, but the idea, he's not the only one out there, you know, looking at this government, Christopher Dickey, in Israel right now and saying, we've seen, you know, recalcitrance here. Friedman saying this government plunges Israel into deeper global isolation, drags America along with it. That doesn't sound good to an ordinary American reader if that's the case.
Well, that is going to happen, and I think that Obama bears some responsibility for that. But, you know, U.S. policy going back a long way bears responsibility for that. You know, the real problem that Obama has goes back to the first year of his mandate, when he overbid what he could do, when in fact he thought he had that moment. He thought that his own election had created a kind of a new environment, a new sense of possibilities, and indeed it had. But when he came out and said, basically, the settlements have to stop, full stop, and then then Netanyahu just simply refused to do it, he suddenly found himself in a very weak position. And he's never really recovered from that in his dealings with the Israelis. So I think Aaron is right. You know, Aaron's a little bit funny where he's talking, he's very negative about Obama, and then he says, essentially, Obama's doing exactly the right thing, the only thing he can do at this moment. And I think that's probably true. I don't think Obama's in a position to come out and say, oh, well, what the hell, let's back membership in the United Nations for the Palestinians. That's clearly not what he's going to do and not what he could do.
Aaron, I'll come to you with that, but we have so many callers. First, Steve in Ames, Iowa. Steve, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
As someone who received a red medic alert dog tag, which was required to be worn on the outside of his uniform during full uniform inspections and changed my career opportunity and experience in the military in the United States, an American Jew who really was kind of sheltered from these issues by his parents, the first generation since the Shoah, the genocide of World War II, I really stand strong with President Barack Obama, who does have two of his three names, or after all, Semite names, on the fact that he stated at the UN of the genocide and of the need for a secure homeland for the Jewish people. Now, I would like to coin the term, or refer to the term as I do sometimes at my Unitarian get-togethers with my fellow descendants of Abraham who are Arabs. I refer to it humorously as the Israel Spring, because I would love to see a two-state solution go forward. I would love to see some progress on a two-state solution. I totally agree with President Obama, who says it's not, the issue is not, you know, the goal, it's how we get there. That's completely correct. And the main thing that I'm a little worried about, and I don't want to hazard any concerns for my relatives, but I have an evacuation plan, because it's the survival of my people. And as somebody with a genetic trait that is uniquely Jewish, you know, and that kind of brought me from being an American.
You're still remembering the Holocaust, and you're thinking survival and looking at this. At the same time, we're seeing a lot of reporting about how Israel's diplomatic situation has really gotten rougher in recent months. But, Steve, let us hold that. Appreciate your call. And one more, Susie in Columbus, Ohio. Susie, you're on.
Thanks, Tom. I'm disappointed in Obama because I think it's our U.S. $4 billion and more a year to Israel's war machine that keeps the illegal Israeli occupation and siege going, and that the Israel lobby should be required to register as the agent of a foreign government, and that that would solve the problems that Christopher and David have pointed out, that Congress would not be owned by a foreign government, Israel, if they were required to register the way everybody else is.
I mean, you say owned, but these are elected American representatives, a lot of them standing very strong with Israel here. Of course, there's a lot of influence. There's all kinds of influence in the U.S. Congress. Do you think President Obama should just stand aside and let this go through at the U.N., Susie?
Yes, I do, and I think he should stand for principle. I think it's an easy decision. You just follow through, you know, and not be a hypocrite. And I think that if they had been required to register as the agents of a foreign government, that he would not have had to back down on the settlement.
Yeah, Susie, we've got yours as well. I've got it. Thank you very much. And one more, Louisville, Kentucky. Charles, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing today?
All right. What do you see?
I see the same thing your previous caller mentioned. I think with the principles that America was founded on, we should allow any other state that demonstrates the ability and the want to become a democracy to try to move towards peace and freedom to allow to do that, whether the means be through negotiations, whether it be through the United Nations, where when I was brought up as a youth, that was the extreme guiding light.
What if that might represent a threat to an ally, Israel? What about that situation, Charles?
I honestly don't think that it could represent a threat to our ally, and I do agree that Israel should remain our number one ally within the region and therefore still receive the backing and the help that we do provide. But at the same time, too, can we not create more allies within the same region?
Or lose them, or as this all unfolds. Charles, thanks for your call. I mean, Chris Dickey, you hear the range of opinion there, and it's the same one we get every time, and yet here's the U.S. over this big barrel with Israel here in a region that's changing.
Yeah, and, I just would not like to be Barack Obama in this situation. I mean, I think there's all kinds of good reasons for the United States to support Israel. But, of course, in supporting Israel, it's always put in the position where it winds up having to support governments that it may not agree with at all. And the really big stakes for the United States now are in the Arab world, and for Israel as well. If the United States loses its voice and influence in the Arab world, that will not help Israel.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the Palestinian move for full membership at the United Nations, the trappings of statehood and recognition right there, and its implications for the Palestinians, for Israel, for the United States. With Aaron David Miller, he's at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, has spent many years in the middle of negotiations and attempted negotiations, Israeli-Palestinian. His forthcoming book is Can America Have Another Great President? Sounds like he thinks it's up against the big odds there, but we'll need one. And Christopher Dickey is with us from New York, Paris Bureau Chief and Middle East Editor for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, author of Securing the City. Aaron, just play out for a moment, because we've got people saying, no way, don't do this, veto this. What if they didn't? What if the U.S. just sort of stood aside and let this go through? What might that mean? Just a hypothetical. It's clearly not going to happen. But if they did, what might that mean?
You know, if I were the president and Abbas truly frontally presents this campaign for U.N. membership and insists on a vote now, which he's not going to do, by the way, because he doesn't want to produce the negative outcomes. He doesn't want to produce a cutoff in congressional aid. He doesn't want to produce undermining Israeli-Palestinian security cooperation.
I mean, he's going to fold before he gets to the podium or before he gets
to
the Security Council?
Not fold. I think he'll deposit. He'll apply. But I don't think he's going to press for a vote right now. There may be a General Assembly resolution, which, frankly, practically speaking, if you wanted to worry about something, I guess if you were the United States or Israel, and I'm not worried about either of these things, you would worry about a situation in which the PLO status would be elevated from a non-member entity to a non-member state. They'd have access to the ICC, the International Court of Justice,
right. And
you'd get off on an entirely new tangent where the focal point would not be negotiations at all, but an international arena where the Palestinians rightly and arguably have much more influence than they do in a bilateral negotiating framework.
To sue Israel, to bring people to the international court and all that.
Exactly. And then that would be accompanied, of course, by massive mobilization of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, pressing against the checkpoints, pressing against the settlements. And if they could presumably keep their protests peaceful, there were no use of live fire on the Palestinian side, no Molotov cocktails, you'd end up with a disproportionate Israeli response, and you'd end up with you would take the whole issue of mobilization to Arab Spring-like, and I hate that word, to a level that we have not seen in the West Bank. So that would be a paradigm change.
Okay. What about the Security Council avenue then?
I mean, look, if I were the president and Abbas presents, I'd veto. I'd veto and I'd sleep well that night, because it is not in the interest of the United States to admit a state that pretends to be a state, to admit a state half of which is controlled by an organization that doesn't even agree with the whole notion of producing a two-state outcome as a conflict ender.
The Palestinians don't?
Well, I'm talking about Hamas, that doesn't have a monopoly over the forces of violence within its own society, that doesn't have control over all of its people, that doesn't have control over all of its guns or its negotiating strategy. So for the United States to simply step aside and allow this, what I would call, and I have called, Humpty Dumpty Palestine I don't think makes sense for American interests. It certainly doesn't make sense for Barack Obama's political interests. And if, Chris and Tom, there is any hope, and I would argue right now there is none, of a conflict-ending agreement between Israelis and Palestinians, this would certainly make that almost impossible, because I know exactly how the Israelis will respond. They will say to the Palestinians, okay, you set your borders. You, through what the Palestinians believe is not a unilateral act, but you, through unilateral action, have set your borders. The international community has set your borders. Well, guess what? We're going to determine what territory we need as part of the West Bank, and we'll leave you with the rest. And I can see a unilateral move on the part of the Israelis, which would make getting to a two-state solution even harder. So as grim as negotiations are, I am not encouraging the Palestinians to run back to the negotiating table. Let me say that flat out.
Really? I mean, because... But that's what Olmert said. Why is Ehud Olmert saying that?
You know, with all due respect to Ehud Olmert...
You don't care about a lot of people. The former prime minister...
I care about who is in power and who has the power to actually deliver on what they say. I would prefer a UN General Assembly resolution. I would prefer a UN General Assembly resolution than another false start and false promise and some cleverly worded fix on the part of the Obama administration that will set into motion another process which will collapse and make the situation, if it could be worse, worse than it is now.
Look, you've got a lot of experience there, a lot, and we respect that. On the other hand, Christopher Dickey, here you've got a former prime minister of Israel, and granted, he's not in power. The complexion of power in Israel has changed a lot, but he's saying, Ehud Olmert, who was prime minister until 2009, we Israelis simply do not have the luxury of spending more time postponing a solution. Chris Dickey, do you see a scenario where this might, Abbas raises it tomorrow at the UN, then it goes into some kind of hiatus during which there is some serious negotiation here, or is that impossible with the current configuration?
It's pretty much impossible. Aaron's right about that. I get the feeling that Aaron would like to see that paradigm shift, that shift toward a mass popular movement, nonviolent, really putting pressure on the Israelis at the same time that you had observer status, what the French have proposed, giving the Palestinians a means of using international institutions to put added pressure on the Israelis. And that may be what it takes to get to what Olmert's talking about, because what you've got to look back over the last 10 years or so, the Bush administration particularly gave away the key issues that the Palestinians had to deal with. What is it that the Palestinians have to negotiate with? Mm. They don't control the land. They don't have much money. Their birth rate is certainly an issue. But they don't, and if they use violence, they're terrorists, and they certainly have been in the past. So what is it they're supposed to use? They can use diplomacy and they can use protest. And in fact, what Aaron's talking about, he doesn't think it's going to happen, but what Aaron was talking about is a means for them to use diplomacy and protest in new ways that they never had before.
And the president talked yesterday in his speech about something new that they may be seen as having. Here's the president in his speech at the UN talking about the whole Middle East changing.
So this has been a remarkable year. The Gaddafi regime is over. Gbagbo, Ben Ali, Mubarak are no longer in power. Osama bin Laden is gone, and the idea that change could only come through violence has been buried with him. Something's happening in our world. The way things have been is not the way that they will be.
Maybe, but in American politics, it's dangerous to get out on that limb. Here's Republican candidate Mitt Romney talking with Fox News' Sean Hannity this summer about President Obama's Middle East policies. He accused the president of disrespecting Israel, of violating a, quote, first principle American foreign policy, which is to stand firm by our friends.
We don't negotiate with terrorists, and the president was suggesting that Israel should negotiate with terrorists. And that's why people like myself believe that he threw Israel under the bus.
Israel under the bus. Devin in Boston is calling. Hi, Devin. Thanks. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I just would like to add some context to the conversation, you know, as a Palestinian American here.
Okay.
My grandfather, and, you know, born in the 1920s, through the 30s and 40s, worked toward and was passionate about self-determination for Palestine. And so there's a colonial piece here that is not, is needs to be part of the conversation because, you know, first, whether it be the Ottomans, my grandfather was born into the Ottoman Empire colonial situation, whoever the next, you know, now it's Israel, there's a piece here that Abbas is not just all of a sudden going and asking for self-determination.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so much history. But let me ask you, Devin, at this point, after all that history and all that pain on both sides, do you think the Palestinians, with a state, are ready to live in peace next to an Israeli state, a Jewish state?
Well, I think it's really interesting because this question has been asked, you know, for a long time. And when my answer is, of course, yes. But to back that, it's something that even in, you know, back in the 40s, this question was being asked. And a lot of people were saying that, oh, no, you know, they're not ready to be. And in fact, even in the 1920s, the whole reason that the British mandate was legitimized was because, oh, the Palestinian Arabs, they're not ready to be a state. And a lot of that is rooted in racism and the idea that Europeans have and Westerners have the privilege to define who is ready to be a state. You know, Palestinians are saying and have been.
I'm not asking about a state. I'm asking about peace. If they're prepared to live peacefully next door to a Jewish Israel.
Well, where there's oppression, there's resistance. I mean, I think we need to also be talking about justice and having access to human rights, and people will be peaceful when they have those privileges. You know, my grandfather fought against the Nazis, the General Rommel in Libya. In 1942, for the British, with the understanding that he will have a Palestinian state. That was, you know, why they recruited.
I understand it, but there's that question standing there, Devin, and I don't hear you going right to it. You know, whether the Palestinians would be willing to live next, if they're not willing to do that, then whatever you think of the justice of it, it's hard to see how we're going to have any agreement here. But maybe they are.
Palestinians, what is it? Palestinians, you know, for me, in my understanding, the family I have back home, they're willing to live in peace with their neighbors.
That would be awesome. Devin, thanks. And Brandon in Buffalo, New York. Brandon, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Yes.
I'd like to answer the question you just asked your previous caller and say I believe that if Israel left Palestine alone, then they would all be willing to live peacefully next door to each other just as much as any other predominantly Muslim or Islamic nation is willing to live next door to Israel.
Well, but there's a lot of history here, Brandon. I mean, there have been, you know, attacks and... Yeah.
My comment is simply you referred to Israel as our ally, and you said that we may... earlier in the show, and you said that we may possibly lose an ally, and someone said we may possibly gain allies. My question about that is simply... What does Israel bring to the table as an ally? Britain, France, Germany stand by our side in conflicts. Israel stands by our side to the podium. What do they bring to the table as an ally? And that's pretty much all I've got.
Okay, Brandon, I appreciate your call. Now, in fairness right there, in recent conflicts, Israel has done a lot on the intelligence side and the rest. But, Christopher Dickey, what about that question? If Americans are looking at this calculus, for those who say, well, what about the cost of this relationship the president says is inviolable? How do you look at the balance sheet now?
Well, you know, you have to go through everybody's narrative, and that's a long story. I mean, one of the reasons that when it comes to the question of being an ally, yes, intelligence sharing, but also the United States is an intelligence target for Israel.
Yes.
So there are all kinds of issues there.
True.
Israel has been closer to getting us into wars than getting us out of them over the years. That's certainly true. I think it's a legitimate question, and it's one that didn't used to be asked very much. It's interesting to hear it aired like that. On the other hand, you know, the United States has enormous sympathy with Israel since its creation. One of the reasons it's so hard to make peace is that a large part of the population of Israel are Sephardic Arab Jews who were expelled from their countries by the Arab governments and who don't forget that. So there are a huge number of issues and a lot of different narratives of repression on both sides. What I think one of the callers made the point, however, that if you end the occupation of the territories, you will go a long way toward finding some kind of peace. And that probably is true. There will be people who do not give up, who will be violent, who will continue to want to attack Israel. But they can be marginalized once Israel pulls out of the territories. If it stays in the territories, just as the United States staying in Iraq or the United States staying in Afghanistan, it is going to create a lot of resentment. People hate occupiers, and it doesn't matter what their motives are, how good they are, how benevolent they want to be, and we're not talking about benevolence in this case. People hate occupiers, and that's not going to go away.
Ty in Boston, you're on the air, Ty.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to make a couple of comments here regarding everything that's going on in the region right now. The main issue, in my opinion, is not the willingness of Israel or the Western world or the United States to create peace with the Palestinians. It's more of the willingness of the Arab world to, first of all, accept the Palestinians as a legitimate country and not use them as a tool of war. Because that's what has been happening for since basically the creation of Israel.
Ty, my screen, little screen here says that you are an Israeli. You've been watching this then for a while. Is it different when it's not necessarily dictators using the issue in that way, but after what we've seen this year in Egypt and elsewhere, when you've got the people in the streets? Is it different?
It's different, but you have to kind of look back at the whole history of the region and understand that we're coming in as a democracy. You know, the United States. I'm an American too. I've been living here for
great.
A while.
Yep.
We're coming in as a democracy, trying to create democracy or understand it as it comes in those countries, and those are people who are uneducated. They've never been.
You know, Egyptians are going to argue with that right now after Tahrir Square. They're going to say, look, we're trying to make democracy ourselves here. We don't need your help necessarily. Ty, I appreciate your call. Our time is short. Aaron David Miller, I mean, here's a region watching what's unfolding here after what we've all seen this year, its successes and failures and still uncertainties. But what about this? Ty says that's the issue, how the big countries around Israel and the Palestinians respond here.
Well, I mean, I think that's it's an important point, and I think the president, again, risks becoming all too breathless in his description of what's happening. The arc of change in these movements is going to be a very long arc. Even in the best of examples, Egypt, a coherent state with a tradition of governance, political parties, a constitution, an opposition before Nasser, is facing a situation in which 6 months into the so-called Arab Spring, and I would argue in many places the Arab Spring is turning into an Arab winter, you have a situation in which security is deteriorating, the economy is deteriorating, the tourism industry is deteriorating, and the Ikhwan, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the military, the SCAF,
but does that
are
mean
essentially crowding out the forces of real progressivism and change.
Does that mean
that
Israel can just
you,
sit tight?
You Tahrir, I didn't. I mean, that's a separate question, Tom.
Yeah.
And the answer is no. I think Israelis need to get ahead of the curve, but doubtful it's going to happen.
The curve is moving fast here in the UN this week. Wow, always hard to get answers here, but we're really grateful to the two of you for helping us look into this whole situation. Aaron David Miller with us today from Washington. His book out next year is Can America Have Another Great President? Thank you very much for being with us, Aaron.
Pleasure, Tom.
Christopher Dickey with us from New York, Paris Bureau Chief and Middle East Editor for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. Chris Dickey, thank you very much for your time and thoughts.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.